On This Week in Tech, the Silk Road gets shut down, Adobe and Microsoft get owned, IKEA sells a solar ooze, and yes, we've got spinning cubes of death. Coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 426, recorded October 6, 2013. Solar Oomla. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. Follow Audible on Twitter, user ID, audible_com. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code TWIT1013. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TWIT10. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with coworkers and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even present from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code TWIT. This is TWIT, This Week in Tech. It's the show where we take the tech news of the week, push it together in high pressures until there's like a big bang explosion, and boom, we've got a golden iPhone. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, in for Leo Laporte, who's on his way back from a well-deserved vacation. But I didn't come alone. My Big Bang panel starts with Mr. Patrick Norton next to me in studio. Patrick, the star of Techzilla, and this week in computer hardware here on the TWiT TV network. Patrick, thank you for making the drive all the way up here.
My pleasure.
You know, what are you working on recently? I saw you pulling up, and it looked like you were moving someone's sofa.
That's actually a small sofa for the reading area, for the library, for my son's school that my wife is building.
So, sort of dad stuff.
Dad stuff.
You are such a dad.
Yeah. I am a dad.
You know who else is a dad? Mr. Brian Brushwood, the man, the myth, the legend, the scam meister who eats fire.
Yeah, and I try to keep all of this a secret from you. You're just outing me. Now people will know I had sex once, maybe three times.
Well, we have it on tape. No, but seriously, what we do have is you in some sort of hotel room. Tell us, where are you right now?
I am down in Los Angeles. I actually just did a three-day, I was asked to give two lectures and perform a live stage show at this intensive that's hosted by Neil Strauss, the guy who wrote The Game, the New York Times bestselling book about the pickup artist community. He's got this whole thing on life hacking that he was doing that I got to talk about. As a matter of fact, today I just got to learn a brand new way to escape from zip ties or from duct tape that I had never seen before. It was really awesome.
Any knowledge that you could pass on to the studio audience, which may at one point or another be tied in zip ties?
I totally will. On an upcoming episode of Scam School. Watch for that.
You gotta tease. There's a professional, gentlemen. There's a professional. You know who else is joining us? Another consummate professional and a good friend of the show, Mr. Patrick Beja. Patrick, thank you for coming in. What time is it over there?
It is 17 minutes past midnight, so it's past my bedtime by about 2 hours, you know.
We should be ending right about the time that you should be waking up.
Exactly. That's what I usually aim for when I come on TWiT. And it's always an immense pleasure, so it works out.
Well, there we go. That's your panel. The die is cast. Let's get right into it. We've got, I think we can all agree, the biggest story of the past week was the busting of Silk Road. Now, this was a website in sort of the dark net, the gray, seedy area of the internet that you could only access through the Tor network. For those who don't know what the Tor network is, think of it as, an onion. That's what Tor is, the onion router.
Right.
That allows you to gain anonymity because as your packets pass from one router to the next, they only know the next router that they're going to. It's a nice way to sort of guarantee that someone can't track back your actual IP address. Well, we covered a little bit about the Tor network not too long ago and how it had been compromised by the federal government. So I guess it was only a matter of time before they busted the biggest website in this darknet, and that was the Silk Road. Now, Silk Road, for those who, again, maybe haven't been jumping around on the Tor network, was sort of a clearinghouse for things illegal on the internet. You could buy narcotics, you could buy card swipes, you could pretty much sell and trade anything using Bitcoin. Now, Patrick,
I'd like to point out that my co-host on TechZilla and AC Nation, Robert Heron, bought Twinkies using Bitcoins on the Silk Road.
Right. So it doesn't all have to be illegal. In fact, I will also admit I've dabbled a little bit in Tor, a little bit in the Silk Road, just to see what you could have sent to your house. Patrick or Schwood, have either of you ever played with Silk Road at all?
No, you were going to say Bitcoin, but then you go straight to Silk Road, and the answer is hell's no. But I'm fascinated. I'm fascinated by, Silk Road sort of rose to prominence by having a best practices for anonymity to protect everyone. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, the shutting down, and of course, there's horrific stuff on Silk Road. You know, everything from, you could buy pornography, you could contract killings, you could have drugs. People were selling fraudulent IDs that they would ship over. Nobody's defending what was sold on Silk Road. But I wonder if one of the things that's happening is there's a lot of talk about how the federal government was able to take down Silk Road. And I wonder if all that's going to generate is another layer of best practices for underground transfer of materials. In many ways, isn't us reading about the takedown of this just setting the stage for the next thing to take its place? Not unlike the Dread Pirate Roberts itself.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Sorry. First, Patrick, not Patrick. I'm sorry. We've got two Patricks on the show, so you have to be not Patrick. You wanted to say something?
Yeah. It's my Twitter handle, so yeah, fair enough. But yeah, you know, there are two really interesting things, I think, that we heard in this story. First of all, you mentioned that the government sort of broke into the Tor network. And in the case of Silk Road, at least, they didn't actually use any, you know, they didn't break into that to get the identity of the guy. They actually used pretty standard, if you want to boil it down to what it comes to, it's a web search. They found the guy through a forums. It was on Stack Overflow, I think, where he made a rookie mistake posting with his name for 1 minute and then changing it to his nickname. So the anonymity of Tor, from what I understand, and Silk Road is kind of still intact. And the other thing is, you were talking about the fact that we could buy really trivial things on Silk Road as well. Now, I personally never went there, but a lot of what we're hearing from, I'm sorry, I forgot the name, Ulbrich.
Ross.
He has, exactly, yeah. So he has some ideological, at least the excuses he's giving are somewhat ideological. He wants to create an anarchist experiment / utopia with this tool. Now, of course, there are things that contradict this ideology in the way he acts, but from what he's saying, it isn't intrinsically destined to be used by for illegal activities.
Right. I think there's actually a really good comparison here between Tor and torrents. By the way, the two are not the same for anyone who might be wondering about that. In that people just associate torrents with illegal stuff, with movies. But there are perfectly legitimate uses for a very good technology like torrents. Same thing goes for the Onion router, for that anonymity network. It could be used for many good things, protecting dissidents in countries that are monitoring the internet, for making sure that your transactions aren't being monitored by a third party. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, the same sort of security that's baked into Tor has been emulated by several perfectly legitimate security vendors. So, you know, I hope that this is not that moment where people just assume anyone running Tor must be a criminal. Patrick?
No, it's not. And it's what's funny about this is not to get anything started about the NSA, but the NSA hates Tor because Tor is a wicked ripping pain in the ass to crack, and they don't have much success with it. So there's some of the documents that have been released recently point out that these sort of the irritation that Tor brings to the NSA.
Even though, ironically, the federal government finances, what is it, like 60% of Tor, because they want to have a protected way for dissidents and for journalists to be able to report from within regimes overseas.
But, Brian, those are the good dissidents, Brian, right? I mean, the good ones. We want those.
Don't even get that conversation started with this crew. But what's funny, though, is you know, the Ars Technica had a really good article on this, and one of the things they do is this was plain old-fashioned police work on a large scale with the FBI, with a lot of subpoenas, where they basically found, you know, one of the first mentions, and who, you know, the one of the first mentions was from Altoid on a site about mushrooms, and they referred a WordPress blog, and that had been created, and they worked their way, they worked the case. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a case of this is like classic hard police work. And it's kind of funny that this guy, the Dread Pirate Roberts, you know, Ulrich, who was like very peace, love, and understanding and against force, was like, somebody's trying to blackmail my clients. I'm going to call a hit out on them. Which is, this is really, it's that's old that's school exactly North happened, Jersey, yeah. Lower Manhattan death.
He paid $80,000 to hire a hitman to take out a former associate. And you know, and the FBI did an old-fashioned sting. They had someone pose as a hitman. Mm-hmm. He transferred $80,000 in bitcoins. Boom, they had their proof, and they went in to make the bust. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. This story, unfortunately, will be seen by some as, oh, well, the Tor network is now insecure. The Tor network is forever doomed. I don't think so. They didn't break the Tor network mm-hmm. to make this work. In fact, there was a bust not too long ago dealing with Freedom Hosting ISP, where people assumed that the government had taken over a layer of the Tor network to find the identities of people who were trading in kiddie porn. That wasn't the case. What they had done was they had hacked the servers that they were accessing, and they installed malware, which infected the people who were visiting. It's not quite old-fashioned police work, but it's the same sort of thing. They didn't bust the mechanism. Right. They busted the person on the other side of the screen. Now, my question to Patrick, to not Patrick, is, you know, does that mean anything? Is that fine line? I mean, to say, look, the government did their job. They didn't violate what we think is the inalienable right to be anonymous on the internet, but they did get some bad people.
Well, it's definitely good that they got the guys they were looking for. And I think it's also very good that they didn't either manage or need to crack Tor as a network, mm-hmm. because first of all, it would have validated probably more surveillance somehow. With everything we've been talking about for a few months, the ability to crack something, defeat some anonymization system would have put more strength in the fact that they would need more of these kinds of tools. Thankfully, they didn't manage to do that, or they didn't need to do it. It's also interesting that they're being, maybe not quiet, but I mean, we're not hearing so much that, look, this is just good police work. And I think that should be pointed out a little bit more. Now, to come back to what you were saying earlier, you're saying that Tor is being viewed in a, you know, with this suspect kind of people who use Tor must be doing something bad. I personally haven't seen that all that much. Silk Road, definitely. But Tor is still sort of in that neutral gray mm-hmm. area of this is a tool and some people will use it for good stuff, some people for bad stuff. Is that something that you guys are seeing in the US, that Tor is now suspect?
Man, I got to be honest. Like, Tor is so sort of
underground.
I mean, even here among the Twit audience, we're having to explain what Tor is to a lot of people. That's how fringe and underground it is. I don't know that it really has a reputation that can be affected one way or the other. But one parallel that I'd like to explore is in the days of you know, using air quotes here, stealing music, Napster ran supreme and was the central hub by which everybody, you know, dealt with their music or got their illegal downloads. And then once Napster went away, you saw an increase in the anonymity side of thing. You saw distributed hosting with BitTorrent, and that became the way people started to share all their stuff. Right now, if there's one person you don't want to be right now, it's a client of Silk Road, because all the servers have been nabbed by the federal government. They have all kinds of information that they're going to use to track down people, whether it's, you know, people offering fraudulent whatevers or drugs or whatever. Like, all this crap is going to roll downhill. The head has been cut off of this beast, and now they're going to feast on the innards of all these lower-level criminals. Are we going to see the same thing again, where now, all of a sudden, the next structure will induce or create some kind of double blindness to where because that's probably right now, if you're somebody who wants to sell, you know, meth or cocaine or whatever, and you go to Silk Road, you trust the reputation of Silk Road to be this repository that's above reproach. And now you've seen that's not the case. I would imagine that future clients of whatever takes its place will want some kind of security on their end that they won't be able to, even if they get taken down, that they're not going to be found out.
You know, interesting security note here. We have been so focused on the transport layer, the pipe that takes data from one point to another. Mm-hmm. That has to be encrypted. That has to be protected. How dare the NSA spy on that? That we kind of forget that eventually that data ends up stored on a physical hard drive somewhere. Right. And if that physical hard drive gets confiscated, and if it hasn't been encrypted, that it doesn't matter how well you encrypt your transport layer, your data is there for the taking.
Well, it also helps, like, one of the reasons servers are located in certain countries and they get routed access to a server, you might have three or four jumps between the public and that server, so that if someone does come after you legally, then they have to go through some of the most privacy-sensitive courts or countries and fight their way through that to get the location of the actual servers. And then get to that server, they have to fight with that country that the server's located in. And then hopefully you've been smart enough to encrypt all of that data. But, you know, there's a reason why there's a reason why, say, Twitter and not a Tor network was used during, you know, certain the Egyptian revolutions, because it's easily accessible. You know, you can dump accounts, you can dump cell phones, you know, but mostly because it was not really complicated to set up. And setting up Tor and servers and encryption and doing all of this is really hard. In fact, the guy that set up the Silk Road basically didn't follow his own advice and left too much information around.
Right. Actually, did you hear? Apparently, the guy who got arrested might not be the original Dread Pirate Roberts. it seems like, well, what he's saying at least is, I'm not the one who set this up. The guy did it and then bestowed upon me the title, and you know that title will be bestowed upon someone else.
Yeah, I heard that the guy he got it from actually wasn't the original Dread Pirate Roberts either.
Every night before I went to bed, he said, "Good work. I'll most likely kill you in the morning." And then one day,
you know, Patrick, all I can say is, as you wish.
Oh man.
Okay, there is another angle to the story that I would like to take, and it does more look at law enforcement, because no matter how we feel, yes, there is a level of law enforcement that we want to see on the internet. We want to see with ventures like this, because obviously Silk Road was not above board. Obviously, they were using Tor to hide some pretty shady dealings. But then there are those who will point to this and say, see, this is why the NSA needs to have backdoors into encryption. This is why the FBI needs to be able to have backdoors into our data centers. And so I think I want to start this off with Chwood. Chwood, I mean, if I'm not doing anything wrong, well, I shouldn't fear, right? I should be totally fine with this.
What is you are fishing with the stinkiest bait of all time. What is this? Look, here's the thing, and I almost wonder if the, you know, the timing of this stuff, who is to say if it was just the right time to take someone down? But I would imagine, if I was on the outside looking in, I would imagine that in the last, say, 2 or 3 months, the popularity and the interest in browsers like Tor has gone through the roof, because we're hearing story after story of every kind of compromised thing, the NSA poking their face all over the place. I would imagine that now would be a very good time, and I would imagine that internally there would be a lot of pressure to show a win for defeating the bad guys by taking down somebody from behind an otherwise secure thing. No, there's no case to be made that the NSA needs a backdoor. If anything, this is in every way a validation for, as you put it, traditional police work, where you have people who know somebody, who somebody makes a mistake and you take them down. And it was all done without breaking encryption. So if anything, this is the evidence that we don't need any backdoors.
Breathe.
Breathe. Breathe. Cleanse. Let it go.
I'm fine. It's fine. Okay. We're all good here.
Okay. Now, not Patrick, you can give us the non-U.S. centric look at this. What do you think about a government agency coming to you as a citizen and saying, look, we need help. old-fashioned police work isn't going to cut it in this century. We need a way to look at these supposedly secure communications, but we promise we're only going to look at the bad guys.
Yeah, so that's the trick question, isn't it? I mean, if you want to go really first layer, then this is exactly what Schwood said. You actually didn't need it in this case, so bad example. If you want to go really deep and philosophical, I think we've discussed this a million times, but I've never heard anyone actually explain why that question that you're asking is invalid. Why people saying, you know, we're just going to use it to catch the bad guys, or we just need to observe everything. And the reason is, everyone says, you know, it has to do with freedom, but we don't have the actual explanation. The reason is, if you are being observed, think of your home. If you know that you're being observed in your home, then you are going to be acting differently. When you're being observed, you're not being completely free to act as you want. That means that your freedom is restricted when you're being observed, when you don't have some space of privacy for yourself. So your freedom is actually being, I can't believe I'm saying this, but is actually being attacked when you don't have a space to be completely private, to be completely your own. And it doesn't matter that it's in the physical space or that it is in the virtual, you know, internet space. Now, if you want me to tell you about the outside of the US perspective, it's that you guys actually in the US, I say, you know, I generalize, you guys don't really care about people outside of the US. The whole debate that you guys have been having is, are we allowed to spy on American citizens or not? The outside of the US question is kind of settled. So we're not so happy about that. And me personally, I would like to, you know, I would like the question to be, are you allowed to spy on everyone in general, not just people in the US?
Oh, I'm sorry. I wasn't listening, not Patrick, because you're not from the U.S.
Keep in mind, like, Patrick Bezier is 100% right. Like the NSA was founded on the idea, like, the whole thing that made my entire youth growing up, you know, we knew about the NSA. We knew they listened to phone calls, but it was always international phone calls. We had this bizarre fig leaf that, like, as long as
it was always
an international phone call, it was
us.
The other and not us. Right, correct. And it's astonishing to me that it's suddenly an issue because we know that they're watching us. They were always watching us. It was a false dichotomy to begin with. And I am hoping that if anything good can come of the horrific realizations that we have, is that maybe in an age where we are seeing the twilight of true privacy, we can establish robust methods to bring that back. The idea that you could say something or be someone in one place and be someone totally different in another place, you know, there's all kinds of extraordinarily legitimate reasons for this, because as many people have said before me, you don't need freedom to say something smart, and you certainly don't need freedom to say something popular. You need freedom, and you need the protections of freedom in order to say something unpopular, outrageous, ridiculous, or crazy. Which time and time again, we see that many of the most important ideas in the human race come from the fringes who say outrageous, stupid things from the outside
they couldn't say
in polite society.
The twilight of true privacy, I got to ask, what makes you think we're heading towards that?
Well, the fact that we all sparkle in the sunlight now and that doughy-eyed chicks keep watching us play baseball.
Well, it happens to me anyways, but you know, it's cool. It's cool. No, but honestly, my stand has always been, if you actually understand how the internet works, if you actually understand how networking works, if you are accessing a server in any other part of the world, I don't care if it's in the United States or in another country, you have to assume that your traffic is being intercepted. It's just so easy to do it in a modern network. So,
okay, and that is correct today, but there is no reason, Father, that we can't create structures that are robust, that anonymize traffic. We can create privacy only if we as a society decide that it's okay for us to live, thrive, and survive in a world where somebody cannot know something. And that's something right now, we're at the dawn of this era of sharing, and we all are fascinated with the fact that we could tweet out photos of our breakfasts, but we're losing something. And I think stories like this make us realize that maybe there's a value to a segregation of different parts of our lives. These firewalls between our public and private lives, I think, is important. And I'm hoping that we will decide as a society to create more structures that make that possible.
Okay, let's go off the rails completely. There was a story this last week about how Google is trying to implement sort of a true authentication system. Mm-hmm. They want it tied to your Google Plus account when you're commenting on YouTube, because their belief is if people have to use their real identities, that we would reduce the amount of trolls. We would reduce the amount of online bullying. If we did head into a society where there was a guarantee of true anonymity, how do we then defend against the trolls?
Well, there's...
No, okay, what...
It's not one or the other. It's not, yeah. I mean, you can have different, you know, uses for different cases. You can have, it doesn't have to be everyone is, you know, absolutely anonymous, or everyone is absolutely, you know, using their real name, because in both cases, you're going to have problems. And I would like to disagree with something that you both said, Padre and Brian. Brian, you said that we didn't have, people were listening all the time before, and that was, we knew it, and, you know, it's always been the case. It's not true. It hasn't been the case.
Hold on. Not Patrick. There's what Padre said is that packets have always been exposed on the internet, and any server in between hither and yon can make a copy of those packets or look at them.
That's what Brian was saying.
Yeah.
He was saying that, you know, the NSA would listen to you, and, you know, but what Padre said was anyone could be listening to you. I mean, at least that's, I think, what you mean. It's true that information on the internet is theoretically available to pretty much anyone. But there's a difference between that and the government looking at all of it. It's like you're walking down the street and you know that someone could be looking at you. But it's different in every street and every city in the country is layered with cameras that are looking at you and analyzing what you do all the time. I'm not saying, you know, one is better than the other. I have my opinion on this, but it's irrelevant here. I'm just saying it is a different thing, and you can't equate them both. All the information being available for anyone to potentially observe on the internet is different from the NSA having arrays of servers looking at and analyzing everything.
And I completely agree with that. It's also amazing, like Bruce Schneier did a great article for The Guardian where he points out the NSA has inserted all these exploits into services. And it's like Snowden basically went out and said, yo, world. And the United States went, oh, and the rest of the world went, oh, God. But what that means is that all of these services that thought they were relatively secure have found out in many cases there's just big old giant holes walking in, or have basically been publicly exposed that they were compelled to do things that are kind of curious and unpleasant. And what's interesting is that, you know, it undermines trust. There's obviously undermined trust in the U.S. The fact that all of this information, I agree with Not Patrick, all this information being warehoused is incredibly creepy and incredibly unsettling, especially, you know, all you got to do is go back to Nixon, who is tasking the FBI to dig up information on his enemies list. It was like 600 or 800 people long, and targeting the FBI to generate information that could be used against his political enemies. This is scary stuff. This is like, you know, less than 45 years ago in the United States. This is a big deal. And I don't want to take anything against the people that work at the NSA, because I've met some of them. They seem to be fine people. And I would love for terrorism to be stopped. And I believe in signals intelligence. But at some point, it gets out of hand. You know,
If I can, let me move things back to Padre SJ's question, which was, how does this tie in with the movement towards real identities on YouTube using Google Plus for the comments? In no way does that shift actually reveal true identities. Instead, what it does is it creates an environment where your reputation matters. If your reputation is this particular identity, you could have five different identities. You can have five different names, and you can create backstories for all of them and histories, and you can comment on each of them. But the ability to hide behind an anonymous brand new name and be given the exact same weight as somebody who has commented and been upvoted hundreds of times beforehand, the fact that that false equality is no longer under the new system, that is significant. You can still, nobody will ever know who you are. You can live your life as a banker and then and you know, leave comments as a transsexual prostitute or whatever. And but as long as you create that
Brian,
persistent
have
reality,
you been spying on me again. Sorry.
Okay, wait. We got to go to an ad, but before that, I do want to tackle one little addendum to this, and that is, if there could be a way to create an online identity that's completely anonymous. It's a third party that we trust that ties it to your real name, so we can guarantee that you only have one of these. That is your online identity. It cannot be tracked back to you, but you have to now protect it. You can't just say ridiculous, trollish stuff on the internet because that actually affects your reputation. Would that be acceptable to both the people who want accountability and the people who want privacy? Patrick.
Well, it still won't interrupt the fact that some people are scum, or some people have no filter, or some people are just sacks of evil with keyboards, and they will say nasty things even if we know who they are. The second thing is, there will never be a third party or a first party that will be able to eliminate all people spoofing identities and creating fake identities on the internet, even
right.
Google.
Right, right.
The solution is clearly we can look to World of Warcraft, because there are characters. There is when I play an MMO, I have my favorite character who I want to do best practices on to get farthest ahead possible. If I want to do something stupid, I make a brand new level one character and then do something stupid because that's a disposable character. What the level one character does has a smaller impact in that world than what the level 60 character does. And likewise, that's the way it should be with comments. In comments, a brand new account with no backstory should have a lower ability to impact the world around them with what he has to say, unless what he has to say is voted up, Reddit style, and makes an impact on the community by the sheer merit of what it has to say. But the ability to fling poo at a wall should not be equal to a real verified ID versus a brand new made one, and this is their first comment.
You know, only if we had someone who worked for Blizzard.
No comment. Absolutely no comment on that.
Okay.
However, I will say two things. First of all, it's very surprising that it took so long. Actually, the surprising thing is that it took so long for Google to implement that in YouTube. It's been an issue for a long time. And I think that the normal situation is that the comments are a little bit more tied to an identity than it currently is. The other thing is, actually, we should probably try and get someone from Korea, from South Korea, to discuss this topic, because if I'm not mistaken, they have this exact system that you were talking about, Padre. They have a unique identifier per person that every service on the web has to use to identify someone. And so basically, there is no way to hide. It's not even that they can have multiple identities. They can only have their own identity, including forums and, any service on the web. I'm sure there are ways to circumvent that, but that's the way the system is designed. So it would be pretty interesting to have someone from there tell us about it.
Absolutely. Now, guys, I know we could go on forever about this topic, but I'm going to call a halt to it. We're going to come back briefly to talk about just a little bit of a tangent. But before we do that, I want to take time to talk about our first sponsor, and that's Audible. You see, this episode of TWiT was sponsored by Audible.com. I remember when the first time I listened to Audible, I didn't quite get it. I didn't understand why I'd want to be listening to books. And it wasn't until I actually got busy that I realized, yeah, this is a really good way to catch up on the books, on the titles, on the literature that people tell me I should be big on. Just this last week, I was on my way over to New York. I knew I had a 5-hour flight. I knew it was going to be a red eye. I don't sleep on planes all that well. So I called back an old faithful favorite and listened to it in audio form. I had already read it, but I listened to Ready Player One. Have you read that book?
I have read that book.
It's one of those books I desperately want turned into a movie. And it was actually narrated by Will Wheaton, which was a wonderful thing because I'm hearing Will Wheaton in my head and I'm picturing everything that's going on in the book, and suddenly the Starship Enterprise shows up. No, that didn't happen. But it is a really good way to catch up on those books that you've always wanted to read, but you just didn't have the time for it. Now, you see, for those who want to give Audible a try, we have a wonderful chance here at TWiT to give you the gift of reading. You see, you could sign up for their Platinum plan using our code, and that gives you 2 free audiobooks to try out and 2 book credits per month. That comes every month. You choose your books, you load them up, and you listen to them when you can, during your commute, during your jog, during your walk, during your private times in the office or at home. It's a great deal for people who enjoy listening to audio programming, and as with other plans, you also get a free subscription to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times daily audio programs. That's all included in your Platinum subscription. Now, you know, for more details and to get 2 free audiobooks about their Platinum offer, I'd like you to go to audible.com/twit2. That's audible.com/twit2, and see if maybe Audible might be the thing that you're missing in your literary life. That's audible.com/twit2. And we thank Audible for their support of This Week in Tech. Slightly a different story, but still kind of connected to Silk Road, is all about Bitcoin. Bitcoin has been in the news recently, and never more so than when they busted Silk Road and realized that they just took a big chunk of the Bitcoins available in the world out of circulation. Now, let's have a little bit of a historical love fest about Bitcoin. It was first introduced for trading on December 30th, 2010. They started trading at about 30 cents per Bitcoin, and not all that promising. Now, the Dread Pirate Roberts posted about Bitcoin on his blog on January 27th, 2011, and just a few days later, Bitcoin was at parity with the U.S. dollar. So there is a tie-in between Silk Road and Bitcoin. It was really one of the first places that showed people that there was a market for Bitcoins and there was a place to use it. Now, on June 7th of this year, Bitcoin hit $30 per Bitcoin. Remember that there was the big chunk of news during the cycle where people were trying to farm Bitcoins because they had become the new market, and mm-hmm. especially when the dollar was weak, it seemed like a good investment. With the takedown of Silk Road, we saw Bitcoin value kind of plummet a little bit and recover slightly. But all of this points to Bitcoin actually being a real currency. It's acting like a currency should act, right? I mean, this is what you would expect from a currency that's not make-believe, that's not just right. there, but it reacts to world conditions. It reacts to the demand for the currency. Does this, the busting of Silk Road, verify that, yes, Bitcoin is a real currency that will continue?
Well, the FBI is...
Patrick first.
Oh, go ahead, Patrick.
it's funny. There's an article on Forbes that says, so they seized about 26,000 Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. The thing is, that's not the 600,000 Bitcoins that actually belong to the Dread Pirate Roberts, which is apparently about 5% of all the Bitcoin currently in existence. But what it does say is the FBI was like, we're going to hold on to them till after the legal. Basically, they're going to hold on to them through the prosecution, the trial, whatever happens. And then, quote, we will probably just liquidate them. So whether or not you believe it's a legitimate currency, it's certainly being treated by the FBI as a legitimate commodity to be sold for the maximum bid. So the FBI at least wants the price of Bitcoins to stay high for the foreseeable future.
Right, right. I think you were going to jump in with some Bitcoin goodness.
Specifically, I'm fascinated by the fact that Bitcoin has a reputation of being like, oh, that's what you'd use to buy drugs or do illegal bull stuff. The question that is fascinating to me is that we saw, what, a 15% drop, right?
Right.
Essentially, the hub of all the dirtiest, filthiest, most Bitcoin-associated malfeasance was shut down all at once, and it only affected the Bitcoin economy 15%. Can you right. imagine? I mean, what would happen to the Chinese yuan if all of online piracy in China were shut down overnight? I would suspect that there would be more than a 15% effect on that.
Right. Or what would happen to the U.S. dollar if Apple just got seized by the U.S. government?
Yeah,
we're
sure,
talking
sure.
about the same sort of effect. That was the big player in the Bitcoin community. And I think, Patrick, you're absolutely right. The fact that the FBI is holding on to it, they understand that it's worth something. It's,
right.
it's not just a virtual number that they can get rid of because it's going to go away after the seizure. They see that, yeah, this is something that people have traded. It has value even though it only exists in a computer.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. The general, depending on whether you refer to the Silk Road in terms of the number of Bitcoins processed or the actual value, but the number being bandied about in U.S. dollars right now is like $1.2 billion in trade, yielding like $80 million in profit for Ulbricht. And it's kind of funny to think about that is you know, it'll be curious, I think, Schwood, looking forward over the next 6 to 10 weeks, because right now, okay, there was a hit, there was a temporary hit, there was a panic, people started to sell them off. I've got a Bitcoin, I have to sell them before my mom finds them, right? Because my mom's going to think I'm buying drugs. But what's kind of interesting is, like, what's going to happen at this point is, will there be an ongoing market, right? Because 5% of the Bitcoins on the planet, you know, the FBI is trying to find that wallet. Once the FBI finds that wallet, they own like one in every 20 Bitcoins. But that still means the vast majority of Bitcoins were circulating back and forth, right? Doing what currency is supposed to do in a healthy economy. So the $64,000 question is, will the value of those continue to rise because there are other avenues for exchange for the Bitcoins? Or will it turn out that this was like where all of the Bitcoins were traveling? Does that make sense? Because I can't speak economist without sounding like an idiot.
I got it. But there's also a story attached to that, and that is there are many users of Silk Road who are now complaining that, well, they're out. They're out tremendous sums of money because the way that it works is you have to deposit your Bitcoins, the way it used to work, into Silk Road, and then you could actually make a transaction. You could make that trade. You could make that buy. You could make a sale. And there are people who are saying, wait a minute. I had $10,000 in Bitcoins in Silk Road. You can't prove I did anything illegal. How could you just take that away from me?
Well, it depends on.
You bought credits. You bought credits in a fantasy world where you'd get drugs and pedophile files, and now those credits are gone. They were gone the moment you spent it, and the fact that the company shut down before you got a chance to spend them. Look, man, if World of Warcraft went away, I'm sorry, not Patrick. I wouldn't say I bought all this gold and where's my value. I'd understand that the company's gone.
I don't really think it's the same thing. I think if the U.S. is, you know, interested in, well, let's even put aside the fact that they, you know, the agency wants to sell them back once the prosecution has concluded. I'm half sure that they will have a phone number. And if you want to get your Bitcoins back, and, you know, you can call up the phone number, say, this is what I use them for. Here are the records. And please give them back, and I'm sure they will be happy to give them back. Of course, I'm also pretty certain that no one is ever going to do that. But it is, if it is considered real value, I believe it is, I'm sure the U.S. can, you know, the agency can give it back.
But would they? I mean, I think that would be a ultimate test of this as a currency.
Yeah.
If this was an operation that was doing things illegally, say a bank that was also dealing in a Ponzi scheme, the U.S. federal government would be absolutely honor-bound, law-bound to try to get back money to the victims of the scheme, maybe people who were unwittingly using the service. Will they do the same thing with Bitcoin, knowing that it's not U.S. currency, it's not any nationally recognized currency, but it's Bitcoin? I think that's when, you know, it may act like a real currency, but until it can receive the same sort of legal protections as a currency, is it actually a currency?
Even if it's not a currency, it's property, isn't it? It's something that those people own. So if, you know, they just happened to bust a warehouse where a bunch of stuff was stored. There was some drugs, some, you know, questionable material, and some Twinkies. And, you know, after they've cleared the Twinkies, I'm sure they can give them back to their owners. Or either that, or, you know, they start paying government workers and in Bitcoins.
Let me go devil's advocate. Let me go, and I don't actually believe this, but I want to stoke the fire a little bit. Is it actual property? It's entirely virtual. When we think of cash, and the reason why we can move around numbers on a computer and think that, yes, that's my cash, is because it actually has its root in a physical object. Bitcoin has no roots in a physical object. Turned it into a physical object.
But the entire stock market is a hallucination. Checks. I write a check to you. That's an agreement. That's an honor-bound thing. That's not a physical object. It's a promise to pay, right? The money in your pocket is a consensual hallucination. Bitcoin ticker available on Bloomberg Terminal for employees, right? XBT. If Bloomberg's recognizing it, if a federal judge has ruled that Bitcoin is real money, you know, then it is a means of exchange and a means of trade. The thing is, like not Patrick was saying, look, if I stored my boat, you know, at, you know, Abel Baker Charlie storage facility. And it turned out that Baker was making meth with Charlie and Abel was selling it. And the entire thing had the FBI swoop down on it and roll everybody up, and all of the stuff would be locked up for X amount of time. You know, and then eventually at some point they would say, hey, if you storage your boat here, let us know. We'll let you get your boat back. And I'd go through the process to get my boat back. What I'm waiting for in this story is some, you know, nice young man or woman is going to be like, I want my bitcoins back. And they're not going to think about the fact that they want their bitcoins back, but now the federal government now has the entire list of trades they did where they were shipping, you know, meth or shrooms or weed or whatever they were selling that was not a legal thing. And at some point there's going to be this rush of stories where stoned idiots ask the FBI to give them back the money they made for selling shrooms. Right? It's sad, well, but it's going to happen.
Yeah, of course, that's why I was saying, you know, probably no one is going to actually go in and request their bitcoins. But there's also another thing. You were pointing out, Patrick, that they want to sell them at the end. Mm-hmm. And they can't both say that it's not real and we can't give it back to you and then turn around and sell them. It's one or the other.
I love that.
And
okay.
I think they want
sell
the
Also, rate, like, right? like the discussion started moments ago with saying, like, the government is treating bitcoins like real money. It doesn't seem, and I don't know how much of this is, you know, one hand not knowing what the other one's up to, but if the government treats bitcoins as real currency, then you have enormous tax implications. And then and if bitcoins are real money, then why isn't World of Warcraft gold real money? There's an actual exchange. And at this point, like, at what point does somebody go to jail for stealing a sword with a Ponzi scheme in game? You know, on the flip side, you have stuff like EVE Online. It has a game structure where people perform real fraudulent activities against other people that defraud them of real value ISK in the game, but it's shrugged off as being part of the game experience. What is the difference between Bitcoin and ISK? They both have exchange rates. They're both manipulated. They're both traded. Who is to say is the U.S. government the one in charge of deciding
nobody's,
what's a real currency?
Nobody's. And nobody, least of all me, is saying the U.S. government is in charge of deciding what's real or legitimate security. Cute emails with somebody in the U.S. government explaining to me why I don't know what I'm talking about. But this is also, like, you know, speaking of Audible and long books that are great to listen to, Cryptonomicon, which was Neal Stephenson's incredible book about sort of creating, you know, currency and value out of nothing, or what defines currency or what defines value. But they were working to create a real encrypted international sort of, you know, internet or code-bound currency. And, you know, people for years, you want to learn a lot about the value of money, spend a lot of time, you know, talking to somebody who grew up in a country where the currency routinely crashed and turned into something that was less useful than toilet paper, because toilet paper was still good for something, but the money wasn't. You know what I mean? And in people, right, the idea of currency takes a radically different shift depending on where you are in the planet. You know, most of the people in this room, well, all the people in most, everybody in this room, most of the people on that are live on this podcast, actually all of us, because I don't think there's been a major currency crash in France in forever. And the U.S. dollar is the standard of trade. So we've had this very stable currency. So we think, like, money is the thing in the bank and it's always good. And if I have a dollar, it's good for something. Talk to somebody who grew up in a country where a dollar suddenly became, like, you know, a quarter of a cent or something even less useful than that, and then other means of exchange become standard. You know, dollars are a consensual hallucination. We all agree that this piece of paper with green ink on it, or multicolored ink on it now since we're fancy and have multicolored money like other countries now, is something that everybody agreed upon. And then everybody agreed that we could use checks, and everybody agreed that this weird piece of plastic with a number and I make a phone call and then it gets automated is a way for money to be exchanged, or value to be exchanged. We're talking about exchanging value. It's complicated and it's mystical, and it's all about the majority of the people or a minority of the people who are important in the scheme buying into it.
Well, and I guess that's in one regard, Bitcoin is infinitely superior to all other forms of currency that come before it, and that structurally it encourages forced scarcity, that the more players you get in the market, the more manipulation you try to have. Like, the very act of trying to mine bitcoins only makes existing bitcoins more secure. And that is astonishing to me. And I certainly hope that whatever happens with the Silk Road story, I hope that the story of Bitcoins is not shut down or affected negatively.
Yeah,
because I mean, I think that there's tremendous potential.
It's also funny that, like, you know, so the original stock market was basically built around people exchanging, you know, subunits of stocks or shares of the Dutch East India Company. And the idea that there were like little subunits of the Dutch East India Company, which is a sign that I've been reading Neal Stephenson again. But you know what I mean? Like, this has been happening for like 600 years, man. We're all just back there again, or 400 years. Math is hard. But it's a problem that's been solved before. It's a problem that will rise again. And yeah, I'm with you. I'm going to be really curious to see what happens to Bitcoin and if it can become a legitimate means of exchange. And how, you know, what does a sub-Bitcoin turn into? And how do I buy, you know, something that costs $2 worth of Bitcoin when a Bitcoin is worth $132? Because, you know, 500 years ago, you would cut, you know, your Spanish doubloon or whatever the hell it was into small pieces, into bits.
Sure.
You know, they're mentioning now in the chat room that we've spent almost an hour talking about Bitcoin-related stories
and drugs
and
hitmen.
I think that's actually a good show. Yeah, hitmen, drugs, and bitcoins. But I do want to throw one more thing at you, just because I don't think any of you have yet gone on the complete rant, and that is there are people in the chat room, and thank you very much, Brian, for bringing up the idea of ISK, you know, in-game currency, and the Bitcoin. The one defense that people seem to use most often when trying to separate the U.S. dollar versus Bitcoin, or the franc from Bitcoin, the euro from Bitcoin, whatever it might be, is, but the Bitcoin and in-game currency is made up. It's pretend money. It doesn't actually mean anything. And when you come down to it, that's really the only argument you can use against a currency like Bitcoin or like in-game currency. Work has gone in to create it. Work has gone in to trade it. Work has gone in, which means it should be worth something. And so we're just saying there's a difference between real in-world currency and digital currency.
I say there is none, and there should be none. And I believe digital currency, I believe Bitcoin is probably, if Bitcoin can weather this storm, this reputation storm with Silk Road, then Bitcoin truly is the future. And it's like the fact that it's got a structure where the more people try to get it for free, the more people try to manipulate it, the better and more secure it becomes, then that's a future I could live with.
Patrick, are you going to Are you going to trade in your euros for Bitcoins?
No, but I really, really, really wish I had purchased a few Bitcoins a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Patrick, are you going to be buying any of those physical Bitcoins you can actually 3D print?
Not at this stage.
No.
I do believe it's here to stay, though. I mean, anecdotally, I've seen a few, you know, developers and web designers accepting Bitcoins. And it doesn't seem like we've been a lot of people have been attacking it and trying to find flaws and trying to see why it wouldn't work. It doesn't seem to be not working. After 3 years and after that issue with Silk Road, it is still around. And as Patrick was saying, if it's still around in 6 weeks, I don't really see how it could go away unless something really unexpected and really catastrophic happens. So maybe I should trade in some euros for Bitcoins. I don't know now. I'm confused.
I think I'm confused could be the episode title. Now, you know, we're gonna come back.
It could be every episode title. Come on, face it, man. Yes.
Well, I mean, if we're not confused, we're not doing our jobs. I think that's what it comes down to, really. But you know what's not confusing, Brian?
What?
Shutterstock.
Name one thing, Padre. Name one thing that's not confusing this whole beguiling world. I'm confused by everything.
Shutterstock?
Oh, no, you're right. Because the problem is, like oftentimes when I want to make something on a website or maybe some kind of video, like, I always think I have to go out and shoot stuff myself. Turns out that's not the case. I flew to Singapore once to take a picture of a Singaporean dollar. Turned out that was a lot of money wasted. I could have just gone to Shutterstock.com, typed in Singaporean dollar, which I don't think is what they call it. Used that photo. Would have had the rights in perpetuity as part of my license, because they got pretty much everything at Shutterstock.
They do. Let me tell you, at Shutterstock.com, you will find the perfect image or video for your next creative project. And whether it's for your website, a publication, an advertising, a video, or any other type of project, Shutterstock most likely has it in their inventory of over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. You see, Shutterstock sources images from around the world and then they put it at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional photographers and artists, and Shutterstock reviews each image individually for content and quality before adding it to its library. Shutterstock adds 20,000 images every day, so every time you visit, you will find something new. That means that every time you're doing a project, you could come back over and over again, and maybe, just maybe, they'll find that perfect picture, that perfect video, that perfect setup for your next project. Shutterstock also offers flexible pricing. You can choose individual image packs or a monthly subscription for the best deal. You can download 25 images a day with any standard subscription. And you can download any image in any size and only pay once. Shutterstock gives you the images that you need to bring your creative projects to the next level. And they make it easy because Shutterstock has sophisticated search tools that let you search and drill down by subject, color, file, type, gender, emotion, and more. It's not just one big potpourri of images and media.
Wait a minute. It sounded like you said emotion. Are you saying like there's a difference between searching robot or sad robot?
That's what I'm telling. I'm telling you right now. You can search for just the sad robot and only find robots, only images that really emote that sadness. That's the kind of sophistication that's... Look, there you go. That's the kind of sophistication that Shutterstock has.
Sad robots.
Sad robots.
That's a lot of sad robots.
That is a lot of sad robots. Why isn't Max Trollbot in there? No, let's continue. Let's continue. But you know what? You know what else, Brian?
Yeah?
That was a question.
Dude, I like this fail robot right there. He's just hanging his head in shame.
Isn't that Keanu Reeves robot?
Oh, no. Oh, but, you know, aside from sad robots, Shutterstock also has shareable lightboxes that let you save images to a lightbox gallery and then access them anytime and share them with other team members. Anyone who's ever done a creative project with more than one person knows how important this is to be able to shoot someone over to somebody else and say, hey, is this what we're looking for? Is this the sad robot that we need? Are these the droids we're looking for? And they have an award-winning iPad app. You get to search on the go, and it uses it to display images during presentations, which means that you can call it up and make it your perfect presentation toolkit. Shutterstock is also a global marketplace. They have a multilingual customer service in more than a dozen international countries and full-time customer support throughout the week. Today, I found a few interesting images on Shutterstock, which Brian helped me to bring out. That sad robot is just, you know, it's something that I've been thinking about for a while, doing some sort of creative project that involves robots with emotions, because, you know, that's well, unique in sci-fi. Now,
sure.
Here's what we would want you to do. And actually, no, I think Brian knows this the best. Brian, how and why would they sign up for a free account?
Well, you sign up for a free account, you take a poke around, and then when you do sign up, because we know you're gonna, why don't you go ahead and knock off, what, 5, 10, 15, screw
no,
all those.
No.
25% off.
There we
I've
go.
I've decided. All you got to use is promo code TWIT1013. That's TWIT1013, 25% off. And not only, people always think about, like, because you're selfish, all of you at home are selfish, and I hate you for it. It's not just the 25%. It's the fact that you're supporting This Week in Tech.
That's right. That's right. If you go to Shutterstock.com and enter in that code TWIT1013, you will support This Week in Tech. And that's why we thank Shutterstock for their support of TWIT. Now, let's get on to a different kind of story, because I think we've had enough of all this hacking and
not me
touring and
drugs,
bitcoins and drugs,
hitmen and virtual currencies,
you know,
and
all this exploit
economics
stuff. So let's talk about a new story. Yeah, let's talk about hacking of IE. That's right. There's a brand new story about... You can see where I'm going
sorry,
with this.
I thought you said a new story. I'm not sure what you mean.
No, but this is new. We've actually got video. This is an interesting story about a new exploit called CVE-2013-3893, which allows people to access a DLL in Internet Explorer that essentially lets them control everything that you're logged into. We called it a browser pivot, and we actually covered it 2 weeks ago on This Week in Enterprise Tech when we had Raphael Mudge, who is one of these Uber programmers who works a lot with Metasploit, who showed us exactly how an exploit like this can work.
Here's a tool I've been working on, and it's called browser pivoting. And I'm going to inject myself as the attacker into the target's Internet Explorer. And what this is going to do, it's going to create a proxy server that I, the attacker, can go through, tunneled through my remote administration tool, And this is going to allow me to access anything that the user's logged into. So if I go to, for example, Yahoo Mail in my browser as the attacker, oh, look, I'm in the user's email.
Now, let's make it clear. This is not an RDP exploit. You're actually using the browser process.
Yeah, I'm in their browser. I'm in my browser on my attacker system. Now I'm able to go through this web application that the user authenticated to without them knowing.
This was,
Listen, I'm sorry. You know, normally I totally respect you in all regards, Padre SJ. But the fact that you allowed him to get away with calling this a browser pivot when clearly it's a mudge budge just defies me.
I will bring it up with him. We're going to have him on the show on a regular basis. So I'm going to have you and him, so you can express your displeasure. No, but I mean, this is one of these exploits that it's probably the most impressive one I've seen in years. Mm-hmm. And he was literally able to do this as we were on the show. He ran Metasploit. He was able to find the vulnerability, insert himself, and start surfing as the user. Now, this is one of these exploits that sends information back to a computer. It doesn't report to a botnet. It actually lets an attacker access any site on your browser that you're logged into as you. I mean, think about how many times you go to a website and it knows who you are, mm-hmm. or your email server, it's already logged in, your financial information, your username and password have been stored so that you don't have to remember it each and every single time. They get access to that if they browser pivot on you.
But so what do they need to actually do this, perform this exploit? Do they need your IP address?
They need you to run internet.
They target you.
They need to run. You need to run Internet Explorer and go to a website, and they run their loads their JavaScript onto your system,
right?
And then hell breaks loose.
If you go to the offending website I get it.
Oh, but
yeah,
see,
it's terrifying.
This is not one of these exploits where you have to visit a site to download the malware onto your computer. So it's built into the Metasploit framework now, which means that anyone with a finger, to use Metasploit properly does take a little bit of skill. It's not a total script kiddie tool, but anyone running the latest version of Metasploit could conceivably walk into a campus network, which is typically not the most protected system on the planet, plug in, scan all the ports and all the IPs that are currently on their network, find the computers that have this vulnerability, drop the vulnerability on top of the icon from that computer, and boom, they now have complete access to everything that person has been doing in IE. Now, here's the really scary part. There are some people who think, well, I would know if someone's remote controlling my computer. That really doesn't work that way. Unless you are paying incredibly close attention, almost superhuman attention to the amount of resources being used by your computer, you would have no idea that someone is doing this, and it would leave no signs that you could pick up later.
Because it just looks like you.
It just looks like you. The computer thinks you're using your browser.
And basically, so somebody logged into, I don't have to go to a website. It's a JavaScript injection, but somebody running Metasploit on my network would be able to squirt this onto my machine.
Correct.
So should we explain there's a fix? I mean, one, why hasn't Microsoft issued a security update for this yet? Because there's a Microsoft fix it, and I love Microsoft fix it because it's this strange little remote thing where it fixes your machine, but as long as it's secure. But why hasn't Microsoft implemented this patch yet?
I think it's because most people at Microsoft use Firefox. Wham. Okay, no, sorry. No, this is a critical vulnerability. This scared me more than anything. A lot of vulnerabilities look scary, but, right. they're so hard to pull off.
Robert, what is it that's special about Internet Explorer that makes this vulnerability uniquely possible on it? I understand is there anything theoretically that says that a similar type of attack couldn't happen on other browsers?
Technically, I guess it could, but they don't use the same DLLs. The problem here was the way that IE is written and the dynamic linking libraries that it uses aren't really locked down, not that well. I mean, because remember, you're always balancing accessibility, flexibility, the ability to use a platform with the ability to keep it secure. This is one of those oopsies. They never thought that someone would be injecting themselves in this way, and now they're getting burned. That's basically the history of security vulnerabilities in Windows or any other platform.
Wait, somebody will climb in through an open window?
Yeah.
Okay, somebody will open an unlocked door. Okay, they can open a locked door if it's a bad lock. Okay, they'll, it's this its layer of crazy, but it's, I love the CVEMITRE.org entry on this. Use after free vulnerability in the set mouse capture implementation and MSHTML.DLL and Microsoft Internet Explorer 6 through 11 allows remote attackers to execute an arbitrary code. It's just obscure, and it's in the IE DLLs. You know, there will be other horrible security problems in the other browsers that just don't happen to be this particular one, Brian.
But
you know, I see the tie-in to our previous discussion because, again, people are always concerned about the transport layer, that pipe I have to the internet being spied on. Right. When, honestly, it's a lot easier to compromise either the end user's computer or the end user himself or the server that the user is accessing. You know, really, this is the stuff we should be worried about. This is the stuff that we should be concerned about. My computer could be owned right now if I had ever actually used Internet Explorer, and I wouldn't have a clue that someone had just accessed all the sites that I had accessed on my browser. Nothing.
So there. Take that, Steve Ballmer.
Speechless.
No, I'm still thinking, like, this is also a great excuse to blame some horrible thing on your computer. Like, it's not me, Mom. It's this Metasploit. My brother ran Metasploit. Triggered it.
Yeah. No. We should mention that there is a fix right now. Hopefully, we'll drop it into the show notes. Microsoft did issue a fix-it in mid-September or so. Yeah. So if you are using IE, if you're stuck with IE, if you love IE, please, please don't surf to another site until you have run that tool.
Yeah, I would just say actually, period, if you are on a Windows box, just run this.
Right.
Just do it, just in case.
Yeah. Okay, you know, okay, guys, I'm done. I'm sick of it. Forget the hacking, forget Tor, forget encryption. Let's go on to something else in the news.
Good news for a change,
let's hear good news. Here we go. So Adobe just got hacked, and evidently they lost a bunch of credit cards and source code. How's that? That sound good for you?
It's not very bad, right? When you say hacked, you mean like somebody just got into some nonsensical side job. It won't affect like clients of Adobe.
Right?
Or
no.
Adobe's core business, right?
It was really non-consequential. It was just, you know, 40 gigabytes worth of data.
I got terabytes of data. What's 40 gigs? What could be in that 40 gigs that would be such a big deal, man?
Well, I mean, the little bit of about 2.9 million customer credit cards.
I'm sorry, it sounded like you said 2.9 million customer credit cards was just hacked from Adobe.
2.9 million.
Yeah. Pretty much anyone who's a client of Adobe. Yeah. Or Adobe's core business may be a little bit compromised.
Well, and the source code for Acrobat.
Yeah.
Which means Reader.
Which means that people now have a much better way to compromise it.
Because PDF files.
Yeah.
They're going away, right?
They're not popular.
Yeah.
If you thought your Adobe Reader was insecure before, now that the bad guys have the actual source code... they're really trying to downplay it, and they're doing one of these things where I don't think they know how to respond to it. So they said, yeah, we've been breached, but it's not that bad. And as details keep trickling out, it's turning out how bad it was. First, it was there's been a breach. Right. We're not sure what was taken. Then there was a breach, and we think some credit cards have been exposed, but it was all the encrypted stuff. Then it became, well, there's 2.9 million credit cards and accounts that have been exposed, and now it's, and they may have walked away with source code for some of our most popular products.
All right. So keeping in you know, theme with my predisposition to be counterintuitive here, is this a weird time to remind people that in cases of fraud, your liability is zero with your credit cards?
Your liability is $50.
It was, but I believe even that's gone. I mean, I'm no expert, but I believe for years it was $50 was the maximum liability, but I believe it's zero now. But essentially, your liability is zero, and there, it's easy and fun for us to say, you know, oh, look, you know, I'd hate to be one of those credit cards or whatever. But the truth is, if you look at your bill, I got signed up once for a $9 free trial for some, you know, Asahi berry crap or whatever, and I went ballistic, changed my credit card number, called and got it rejected on there. It's astonishingly easy to deal with fraud in this digital age. Wow. As long as you pay attention to your bill, and the penalties are astonishingly low if somebody tries to be fraudulent with it.
Unless it turns out that they managed to hit your combined debit credit card, wipe out the contents of your bank account, cause you to bounce a bunch of checks, including maybe your rent check, then you have to turn around, cancel that card, reissue new numbers, and then to figure out whether or not you're going to keep that separate or apart, and then create a whole new set of online payment accounts for that.
First of all, that's why I don't do debit cards. I want somebody else to borrow the money. But second of all, I believe that's been updated recently to where the liability is zero for debit cards as well, theoretically. Now,
the liability may be zero, but it can still
has been taken away.
The liability may be zero, but it can still really screw up your life.
Sure.
Yeah, there's nothing like having someone use your credit card and it's not you. It's just maddening, which is why NotPatrick only deals in Krugerrands.
In Bitcoin, actually. I was lying before. No, I mean, I'm with Brian. I mean, it's obviously a big deal. I think the bigger deal might be the source code for the PDF tools we use could be potential time bombs now. So that's, I think, a bigger deal than the credit card. Obviously, it's a problem, but the credit card thing, the liability, yes, you could be in a situation where your account is emptied and then your checks bounce and that's absolutely true, but overall it's something that we kind of, it's an inconvenience that we agree everyone collectively as a society to live with in order to get the convenience of having a credit card or a debit card. The source code issues might be something that are actually making the whole environment a lot less safe.
Right. See, that's the thing for me. Credit cards are one thing, and it makes for a good story. You can always say, oh, it's 15 million credit cards, and it sounds like it's a bad thing. But honestly, that system pretty much polices itself. If you've got a lot of credit card breaches, the end user, you're not going to be financially affected all that much, even though it can be a major annoyance, inconvenience, so on and so forth. I don't want to minimize that. The source code part of this story is what scares me, because imagine this. Imagine how many times we've heard of a vulnerability with Adobe, with Adobe Reader, with Adobe products. Now, the way that vulnerabilities were exposed was they kept hammering at the executables, they kept hammering at the services until they found holes, and then they would exploit those holes. They don't have to do that anymore. If they have the source code, they can actually go line by line and find out from inside where the weaknesses are going to be, which means they can find weaknesses that they would never have been able to find just by hammering on the executables. This is actually horrible. I mean, imagine how much of the world depends on Adobe products, specifically on Adobe Reader. Now, imagine what would happen if all those computers were suddenly owned. Let's go back to the exploit. Let's say that now that same exploit works in Firefox. It works in Chrome. It works just you sitting at your desktop. That's the kind of access that we're talking about if someone actually has the source code of software you're running on your system.
It's also, I mean, it's pretty brutal. Like, okay, 2.9 million customer credit cards, those were encrypted. You know, assuming it's quality encryption, that data is probably pretty safe. But it's crazy, right? Because this appears to be a group of hackers that have broken into LexisNexis, Dun & Bradstreet, a whole bunch of other interesting places. And that what happened was, I'm reading Krebs on Security, Alex Holden, CISO of Hold Security LLC, discovered a massive 40-gigabyte source code trove stashed on a server used by these cyber criminals. And what's interesting is not so much that they had the source code, but they cracked into the credit card servers and then used that to get access to the rest of Adobe's system. So there's some really bad lack of firewall going on there, or some really sophisticated hacking. But then if I'm reading correctly Adobe's response, Adobe is still in the process of determining what source code for other products may have been accessed by the attackers, which basically means the attackers could have been planting things in the source code to do nefarious stuff later on, which is really frightening for something that is...
That sounds a little bit ambitious for this one attack. But the spectrum of possibility is terrifying.
This isn't one attack. This was something that they just discovered. And the reason they discovered it is because a security officer working on something else stumbled across 40 gigabytes of code, took some screenshots, and went to Adobe and said, hey, does this look familiar? And Adobe went, Yes, that looks familiar.
I'm sorry, Chad. There was something wrong with this mic. If we could wind that back, I think, yeah.
I may have muted.
You know, we are looking at the malware analysis and exploring the different digital assets we have. Right now, the investigation is really into the trail of breadcrumbs of where the bad guys touched.
Ooh. Which is another way of saying, yeah, we know they got this. We don't know what else they got.
And what they did with it.
And what they did with it, where it's going. I mean...
I feel like all of the Twit Network should put together a Get Well Soon card. We could just have the whole internet sign it and send it over.
I smell an NSFW episode. We just... You know what, Adobe? We know you've been feeling under the weather. This is from all of us. Please fix your bleep. Patrick. Okay, Patrick. So let's go back over to the man who can give us the non-American view of this. I'm losing my cookies over this. Does this sound like as big of a story for you as it does for me?
I think you might have a slightly more vested interest in this story because that's your bread and butter. But it's definitely scary. The thing is, not being a security expert, I'm kind of in the shoes of the guy who sees it on the 8 o'clock news and he's being told, oh, holy poo, it's really horrible and the world is gonna end. And I'm like, wait, what? What should I do? Like, what's happening? Can I be safer by doing something? So it's really
yes, stop
scary.
Using the internet.
Well, there you have it. Our advice to you is turn off the internet right now.
That's the lesson from this episode.
Sorry.
Stop using the internet. But yeah, no, it's definitely scary for us too. We use PDFs all the time, and it's ubiquitous and international. So yeah, to answer your question, scary for us as well.
Now, Patrick pulled up a security bulletin from Adobe saying that they're going to be releasing a patch in a few days. My question is,
please.
How do you patch this? They have the source code. You can't, unless you rewrote the program.
They didn't say it would actually fix anything. They just wanted you to know that there's a patch that'll be coming out soon. It's going to make your images clearer. It has nothing to do with this thing.
Well, yeah, update. Yeah, basically update. Check for updates on October 8th. That's all I'm going to say. For Adobe Reader and Acrobat 11.
This is one of those things where you cannot patch this. If they have the source code, unless you're rewriting the entire software.
Unless they found something in the source code that they need to fix.
Oh, wait. Unless they're saying, okay, so we finally started going through our source code and we found all those holes, so we're going to fix them before they get to them.
I don't know. It's funny. Like the Adobe Secure Software Engineering team, the asset blog, they also say it's kind of funny. Like at the same time, they're saying on October 2nd, we are not aware of any zero-day exploits targeting any Adobe products. Adobe announces that they will be doing security patches for their products. So it could... Go Adobe.
So
clean that code.
How is this different from other zero-day exploits?
Okay. Well, no, actually, it's a great question. How is this different from other zero-day exploits? The way that this is different is because when we're talking about a zero-day exploit, it's been created by a couple of, I'll call them security researchers, who have been hammering at a service until they find a hole. They find a way either to overload the stack so they can inject their own code, or they've just found some sort of weakness in the way that data is transferred to and from the service. This is different because they're not attacking. They're not hammering at it. Yeah. They actually have the blueprints. It would be like the difference between someone breaking into a building by going and checking all the windows if they're open, and someone actually having the blueprints from the building so they know, oh, there's an access shaft down there I can get through. That's what we're looking at.
Once you see they're in the building, you can go and lock that access shaft in the same way that you would, you know, closing the window that was open, couldn't you?
Well, yeah, but I mean, they don't know which of the 1,000 different ways to approach this building are going to be used by the attackers. Mm.
So you mean the quantity and the ease with which people who want to exploit these issues in the software is what makes this dangerous.
Correct.
There's going to be more and possibly better hidden attacks.
Right. Oh, put it. How about this? Here's a better way to think about it. If I'm going to run a standard exploit against a service, I have to try 10,000 different things before I get the one thing that works. Right. And so if I'm a good security person, I'm actually looking at all those attempts and I realize, okay, something's brewing, someone's trying to get in. If I have the source code, my attack works the first time and you have no time to prepare because I've never attacked your system except for the one time that it worked.
Right.
That's how that is.
Look, I'm getting real depressed here. We have all these stories about bad guys being taken down and about currencies that may or may not be compromised. We've got stories about people being hacked. I just want one story that's not about somebody who doesn't deserve it somehow getting ahead.
Okay.
I want a merit-based story. What do you got?
I got this. How about this? If you're one of these people who are wonderful enough to own a Tesla,
you're
probably going to die in a fire.
What's funny is that's the story I thought I was setting you up with.
This is where I went.
I have two friends that own Teslas. Please amplify the level of detail on this.
Okay, so we had a story from last week about this mysterious Tesla that caught fire. And, of course, the stock dropped immediately and people were saying, oh, my God, we told you this was going to be horrible. As it turns out, this was a single accident where some driver drove over something and ripped the heck out of the bottom of his car. The car caught on fire. Everyone took pictures of it. And now it's the Tesla Roadster is a death trap. This is one of those things. I want to bring this up because I do believe this is the lighter side of tech, because is this not FUD in all its glory, right? I mean, this is, oh my God, we were right about the electric car. Whereas how many times do we see gas cars burst into flames? How many times do we see accidents destroy cars? But because it's the Tesla, it almost makes me feel that if there was ever an accident with a Tesla Roadster, people would just assume that it's going to kill you.
This is Dungeons and Dragons all over again. The first time anyone saw Dungeons and Dragons and then talking about wizard and conjuring devils or whatever, we're always scared of what's new. So the first concrete example of something we have bad associated with it, we make sure to blow up. Congratulations, Tesla. You're now as awesome as Dungeons and Dragons.
Well, it's interesting to read this, right? Because something I didn't realize about the Model S. So earlier this week, a Model S traveling at highway speed struck a large metal object, apparently a piece of a tractor trailer that had fallen off. The geometry of the object caused a powerful lever action as it went under the car, punching upward and impaling the Model S with a peak force on the order of 25 tons. Only a force of this magnitude would be strong enough to punch a 3-inch diameter hole through the 1/4-inch armor plate protecting the base of the vehicle. So, I knew there was, stuff protecting the batteries, and there's a lot of batteries in a Tesla S. 1/4-inch plate, that's huge. That's twice the thickness of the typical safe used to store things in a home in the United States. That's an incredible amount of steel to wrap around the batteries. That's also an incredible amount of force to act on that steel.
Yeah, well, that's the weird part, which is so many news agencies that ran with this story last week. They were making it out as if, they just hit something on the road, a broom. Bucket. And it's like, no, this was a tank killing shard of steel that got pivoted under the car and ripped into the battery pack. And in that instance, that battery pack is going to catch fire. But I think
while we're on this subject, Padre, what do you think of the fact that Elon Musk personally responds to all of these things? Earlier, we saw Elon Musk respond to a bad review that somebody gave of the Model S, saying that it died mid travel, and of course, he dissected the data to go back and essentially call the guy a liar. And the fact that Elon is personally responding to with explanations over Twitter and of course press releases explaining exactly what happened and pointing out quite correctly that he said, look, if we're going to compare apples to apples, I forget the number, I'm probably wrong here, but he said that gas cars are 20 times more likely to explode in a collision or whatever.
Right. Here's the thing. There are those who are saying, wait a minute, Elon Musk he's acting like the irresponsible
CEO.
Five
times more likely.
Right. I mean, so they say, oh, he should just shut up. He should let us PR people handle this. It's not the job of the CEO to go out there and jump on every negative story about his product. But I'm only going to speak for myself right now, because previously I had been speaking for the entire Catholic Church, but now it's just me. But I love
now
seeing
you
this.
Tell me.
I love seeing this kind of engagement. He is obviously a geek. He is obviously passionate about this. And so I like it when he actually mixes it up with people and says, wait a minute, back off for a second. I know it's fun to point fingers, but before you do that, let me give you the real data, either about the review. Let me show you what the computer said about his battery use, or this, let me show you what actually penetrated the car. And it's surprisingly refreshing to see a CEO do that. That's just me. I don't know if anyone shares that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I agree. Look, I mean, Elon Musk is our real life Tony Stark. And I love the fact that we live in a world where he feels appropriate to jump in and call stuff out on that. You know, and he's right by the numbers. I mean, he gave the numbers. Over 150,000 car fires per year, one vehicle for every 20 million miles, and one fire in over 100. Basically, he lays it out. It's like, you know, his cars by the numbers, and granted the sample size is smaller, is five times safer as far if you're worried about explosions than gas vehicles.
Yeah. Patrick, what about you? Keep doing that. Not Patrick. Is this going to put you off from that Tesla Roadster I know you have reserved?
Probably not. If anything, it's probably going to make me more likely to actually go and buy it. Because I think what you were saying earlier, Brian, is very true. He's not letting his PR people do the talking. And instead, what's happening is that he's talking normal. He's saying what all of us would like people to say in these situations. Sometimes it comes off as a little rough, but usually overall he's just, you know, saying what everyone thinks. And that buys him a lot of sympathy, I think. And he is now, I can't remember, you know, I can't count how many times he's been compared to Tony Stark. But that's a pretty good place to be in. So I'm sure he's rubbing some people the wrong way. But overall, I think it's a very much a net positive for him.
I think he's going to be the reverse Tony Stark. He's making cars and things that save the world now, and then he's going to start making weapons.
He's going to start off as a green technologist. He's going to have such an excellent image that we're going to go like, yay, Tesla, you know, weaponry and planes and destroying things.
And then he makes Skynet.
Then he's going to start womanizing. He's going to become a misogynist. Yeah. He's going to start snarkily replying to the public.
Even his weapons are going to be awesome. He's going to manage to find a way to like build the Death Star or like AT&T's or like something that's going to make it really cool. I have trust in you.
It's going to be smooth. Yeah. By the way, you know, the very first time I ever saw a Tesla dealership, I was walking to the Arc de Triomphe in Paris.
Really?
It's a lovely story.
I'd seen the Tesla, but I'd never actually been in a showroom filled with them. I loved it.
I just like laugh because they're all over the place in this part of Northern California. I'd see a Tesla probably every other day, and it's kind of weird because I know it's not like that in most of the U.S., but it's like they're everywhere.
Isn't that strange?
I
remember the first time I saw a Tesla, I was like, oh, whoa, that's the Tesla, and now it's there's one. Oh, I saw one yesterday. There's one parked down the street.
Sub0721 in the chat room has it. He says the Tesla Gundam. There you go. That's the kind of thing you want to see. Go Elon Musk.
Tesla awesome heavy arms.
Actually, that's pretty awesome. And you know what they do is they'd all have Tesla Gundams, and you'd have like wrestling matches out in the San Francisco Bay, and then you'd be body slamming and giant waves going all over the place, everyone cheering on the sidelines.
I have no problem with that.
I don't know. There's a really interesting article in this on the MIT Technology Review that one of the things they talk about is how the one thing that came out of this that wasn't particularly positive news is it's a reminder of how hard it is to put out lithium ion battery fires. Because apparently they thought they had the fire, the firefighters thought they had the fire out, and then it sort of reignited itself again. So I think it'll be interesting to see that.
Patrick,
it's not like gasoline is like super, you know, non-combustible. So,
it's okay. So, National Fire Protection Association: 17 automobile fires reported every hour, kill an average of 4 people every week. Automobile fires are 10% of reported U.S. fires. So, obviously, there's a lot of gas fires catching on fire. We could talk about the Crown Victoria having the gas tank behind the axle. It's been the result of the death or disfigurement of a lot of police officers or state troopers in the United States. There are flaws. There are flaws with gasoline as a fuel. Because it does do that thing where it goes foomp. But it's interesting at the idea, like, okay, if there is a lot of Teslas in between the San Francisco Fire Department and the Petaluma Fire Department or the Santa Rosa Fire Department, maybe that means all of the fire departments have to put together a better school for putting out lithium-ion battery fires. Or maybe Elon Musk probably already has a crew of engineers at some isolated place lighting lithium-ion batteries on fire, not that they have a lot of spare ones to burn, to figure out the best way to put the fire out. Because if what they're saying is if these things heat up and more electrolyte leaks out as a response to the heat and electrolyte reignites, that's problematic, right? No matter how unlikely it is to happen.
You mentioned the MIT review, which made me instantly think of another awesome story from this week, which was the self-assembling cube robots. Did you guys see this?
The Swarm. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if we're up against a break, but that's definitely something I want to talk about.
You know what? You know what, Brian? We're going to talk about that right after I take some time to talk about a sponsor.
I never saw that coming. I didn't know. Yeah. That's why I was asking if they're happy to break. You never know.
But
there
you
might
know,
be a moment. We got to thank the people who make this Week in Tech possible.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know much about this next sponsor. Who is? They're called what? Maybe you could help me with this. Squarespace. What is that, Brian?
If I'm not mistaken, they're actually named in advance for the MIT robots, which are vaguely cube-like. Squarespace is a robot that will destroy the world. Am I thinking of the right Squarespace?
I think so. I think this episode of This Week in Tech was actually brought to us in part by Squarespace.
Oh, wait. Oh, no. I'm sorry. I thought you said CubeBot.
Okay. My bad.
The fantastic all-in-one platform that allows you to make amazing high-quality blogs, portfolios, or any kind of website. And you don't need to have any kind of background or skill because their templates look so good. Whether you're a CSS wizard or somebody who doesn't know the difference between an H, a T, an M, and an L, then Squarespace has got you covered. If you need an exceptional-looking website and you need it right now and you need it to look good, whether it's on an iPhone, on an Android, on an iPad, whether any kind of tablet or a desktop computer, they're going to make you look fantastic.
Yeah, they are. And you know, one of the things that I love about Squarespace is that they allow me to channel my inner Leo. And what my inner Leo is telling me about Squarespace is that you're going to like them because they're always improving their platform. You see, every time we advertise Squarespace on the Twit Network, they've got new features with new designs, even better support than before, which I didn't think was possible. They've also got beautiful designs. They have more than 20 new templates for you to start with and all the style options that you need to create a unique website for you or your business. Brian knows about this. You know, you don't want to buy into one of these packages and then find a beautiful website that looks just like 1,000 other beautiful websites. They let you
know what?
Customize.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like when I get to a decision gate like this, I ask my inner Leo what I should do. Inner Leo, what kind of website should I get?
You should get the Squarespace website, your inner Leo commands you.
You know, there's something wrong with your inner Leo. You may need to get that looked at. But my inner Leo reminds me that Squarespace has actually won several awards, including from the FWA, the Webbies, from Forbes. That's right. They get awards, just like NSFW show won that big chat realm thing. The thing. That weird.
by the way, one of my favorite stories, and it's a true story, formerly of Totally Rad Show, Jeff Cannata had his personal website on Squarespace, and he used one of the default templates and was surprised to find himself on the list of 50 website, designs to be inspired by. Like, he was on a curated list of, like, this is an exceptional site. And they didn't know that he had just used a default template from Squarespace.
Yeah. And you know, one of the other things that I like about Squarespace is you don't have to be a programmer. It's really that easy to use. And they're inexpensive. In fact, I think they're only about $8 a month, which you know, puts them right in that realm of possibility for even the most novice, the most simple, the most basic user of web services. It's incredibly easy to use. But you know what? If you want some help, Squarespace has a support team that will work with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that $8 plan I talked about, that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So basically, it's a wash with trying to do it yourself. Why would you do it yourself if you could get an entire team of experienced professionals behind you? You know,
keep
Brian,
in mind.
Yeah.
Here's the best part about Squarespace is they use distributed hosting. So if your site suddenly becomes super popular, or better yet, if somebody tries to like DDoS you, they're going to find that they just walked into a club made of diamonds. They're going to be in some kind of diamond club and they won't be able to permeate the walls. They can't take them down. That's the strength of the Diamond Club.
Yeah, and you know what else that Diamond Club does? It does search engine optimization automatically. You may know that SEO wow. thing. Yeah, yeah. It's how you get found on the internet. Yeah. And with Squarespace, they advertise for you. They ensure that your site's content can be found under the search terms that it needs to be found. So if you are, you know, part of that club that's kind of diamondy, you don't have to go and pay another service to do your search engine optimization. It's built into the package.
That's the brilliance of our friends over at Squarespace. Look, tell me two things. All I want to know is how can I try it out for free and how can I give a kickback to our friends here at This Week in Tech?
Well, let me tell you that first part. The first part is it's even better than free. You see, they let you start it with no credit card required. That's right. Not one of those annoying sites that says, yeah, we'll give you a month free, but first give us all the information about you. No, that's not Squarespace's thing. They want you to try the service, see if you like it, see if you're comfortable with it. Then, if you like it, you go ahead and buy it. So when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, and this ad should have convinced you to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use our offer code TWIT10, and you'll get 10% off, and you'll show your support to This Week in Tech. Now, we thank Squarespace for This Week in Tech, but we also thank them for everything they do for the TWIT TV network. Brian, is there really anything better than Squarespace?
I was going to say, like, the birth of my first child, but... And we're gonna go Squarespace.
Yeah, I think we have to go Squarespace. That's how we do things.
You went there straight to the children. Yeah, we went. Shameless.
Ooh, wait. Ooh, okay. Brian, take us away from that. What's this thing about the swarm bots?
Okay, all right. So MIT made this. They made these individual cubes. Each one is about the size of a child's building block. You picture the ABC blocks that you have in your hand. And inside, they figured out that most robots are built for stability. They're built for mobility with legs or some kind of treads or whatever. And that to run those things, you require all kinds of gears. They built these little bots that are they're self-organizing. They're autonomous. And they move purely by a little flywheel inside that spins up to 20,000 RPM. And then by doing it, they realized they could spin it real fast and then stop it. And the block would jump forward. And they discovered this quite by accident. But then they realized that putting magnets on the outside of it would allow them to essentially create, you know, when you watch Transformers and you see, you know, basically a boombox melt into all of a sudden a 20-foot tall robot or whatever, and you're like, nothing can move that way. Or you watch the T-1000 melt into liquid metal and you're like, nothing can move that way. Essentially, they've created a framework that really can do that. These cubes, self-organized, they look like Tetris pieces right now. But and in fact, we just talked about this on the Weird Things podcast. It is astonishing to watch these things in action. I know Chad's going to bring it up on screen right now. Jump to about 2/3 of the way in right now, and you'll be – there you go. Right about there, you'll be able to see these things moving around. And for the first time, you can see how these things could essentially do the stuff that we've only seen in science fiction until now.
Okay, am I the only one terrified by these – spinning blocks of death? is that just me? It's because I'm looking at that thinking this is how I'm gonna die.
No, okay, here's how you're gonna live, because what'll happen is eventually you'll just decide to download your brain into one of these things and then we'll all be awesome gray goo overlords.
I'd rather die and trust my intelligence to whatever comes next. I do not want to be trapped in a spinning box.
Actually, I feel like I am trapped in a spinning box, so that wouldn't be that much of a difference.
I love
stories like this because, you know, especially when you've got students who are just messing around, they've come up with these concepts that someone is going to use this idea of a self-assembling robot, of robots that can create structures with very simple mechanisms. This is going to make its way into some product that eventually will click and someone will say, oh, that's right, why didn't we think of that before?
It's really astonishing.
And maybe not.
Yeah, maybe
it's
not.
It is astonishing. It is definitely something that is super interesting. I mean, to look at it, they look alive. And I guess that's what makes it especially enticing for us. It's technology that really looks, it's not a robot, it's just a box, but it does look somewhat alive. There's a really, 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 really long way from this to something actually useful, though. This is fundamental research, almost. And it could be, I'm playing devil's advocate here, sorry, but it could be that this just remains jumping boxes and it turns into, you know, a children's toy and nothing more. I don't really see how these boxes could become something. You know, you would need to have mechanisms, and like for them to do something else, they would need to have a lot more on board, or like to assemble into different geometric forms that could move in unison. It's very, very early on, and I don't want to be the grouch here, but I could see this become awesome. I could also see this become just, you know, nothing.
You know what, Brian? I now agree with not Patrick. This story is bad, and you should feel bad.
Yes.
I'll tell you what. You say that, I'm going to send my army of 100,000 cube bots to absorb you.
Okay. Let's move on to something else that I think is awesome that is probably also going to be shot down by our esteemed not Patrick. And that is, guess what they're selling at IKEA now? Solar panels.
Q-bots?
So Q-bots that put themselves into solar panels. Now, this is only happening across the pond. It's in 17 British stores. They're talking about a couple of Chinese-made systems that will sell for roughly $9,200. And the idea is now that you can walk into IKEA, and in the same aisle that you buy your USK, which is some sort of desk, you get to buy a system that will go up on the roof and provide at least partial power to your house. Now, this is something that people predicted about solar in the United States so long ago, that you would be able to buy and walk into a Best Buy and buy something that will help to remove yourself from the grid. But it never materialized for any number of reasons, including a lot of regulation. Why is this now possible in British stores?
I mean, to be honest, there's only one thing I care about. Like, do they actually do anything? Are you spending $100 so you can save $9.35 on your overall electric bill? This is conspicuous consumerism. And obviously, this is what happens when you have...
No.
Go on. Lay it on me, Patrick.
Okay, first of all, they're talking about with the what's available in terms of purchasing subsidies in the UK. You're talking about a 7-year payoff on a product that should have a 30-year lifespan, right?
All right, no. You said subsidies, though, right?
Well, okay. Even if it's not, even if it's full $9,000, I think it takes it up to 10-year payoff for a product with a 30-year lifespan. It's like on one hand, I get what you're saying. Like, oh God, just we need somebody else spending $100,000 on an electric car to prove how green they are because they're using coal-generated electricity in their giant lithium-ion-packed vehicle to move without fossil fuels through the highways.
That's exactly what I'm worried about.
No, give me. You got to remember something. I live in Northern California. I drive a 7,000-pound, 3/4-ton diesel truck, but I'm running biodiesel, which is actually domestically produced from recycled freaking Frito-Lay potato chip oil, which means I have a lower footprint in terms of actual carbon energy consumption than a freaking Prius because my fuel has pulled the carbon out of the air recently. Take that back off, lady. Just, I'm going to go hug a tree. I'm doing it in my own way, and my way isn't a Prius. My way can pull an Airstream. Now that I've had my Northern California rant out of the way, I do believe in solar cells. I do believe in solar energy. I do believe in the Million Roof Initiative here in California because the idea, anytime you take digging stuff out of the ground to produce energy, you've done something positive. It may take a while to pay off. You should do the math. You should investigate the company that's offering to do this. But I like the idea of actually self-containing energy inside of a home. This is a good thing, Brian. Don't be all negative about it, please.
Okay, but here's what I'm saying is there's the gap, right? There's what you pay up front. There's the environmental cost of the manufacture of the product.
Right.
It's easy to look at this kind of story and just say, this thing be good. Why is America bad?
Because it's like, IKEA. How could IKEA? IKEA's just, they're just warm and fuzzy. It's not like they create a lot of furniture that ends up in landfills.
You want to know why IKEA's bad? It's because you need a goddamn pirate treasure map to find your way out of the goddamn place. That is not okay.
So your problem isn't, I feel like we're in therapy group. Group, let's all approach Brian with positive energy and bring Brian love. Brian, your issue really isn't with IKEA or conspicuous consumerism. It's the fact that you want to buy some obscure, bizarrely named thing and you can't find it in the big, giant-ass store. Is that right, Brian?
Look, I think we've had a breakthrough here, Patrick.
I think what is interesting, though, is the idea that if it wasn't, you know, you can kind kind of do a version of this with Costco in the United States, where they have a partnership with a solar cell supplier, and you spend $12,000 and you get a box full of solar panels and inverters, and you can put that on the top of your house, or better yet, have an electrician with a clue put it on top of your house. You know, it's just, I think the only reason this is news is because it's IKEA. So it means it's probably, what is its name? I mean, did they talk about its goofy Swedish name?
A Jusk.
A Jusk?
It should be called
Juice Box.
Sjolair. And there's like a slash through the O in Sjolair. And there's an umlaut over the A. I made all of that up. You can have that IKEA. Yeah.
No, but I think that's the idea. The idea is, if it's made it into IKEA, then yes, it is consumable. But I think that's a good thing. I'm with Patrick here. You know, if you're bringing it into the realm of the consumer, of the person who's just making that buy because they think it's going to make their house better, it means it's no longer up in the stratosphere where only those who are either really rich or just really want to show off the solar system on top of their house can buy into this. Now, someone who says, wait a minute, okay, let me do the math here, 10 years, 3 years, whatever it's going to be, after that I get free power, I like that idea. I mean, how can you not like that?
Well, mainly because we oftentimes, and keep in mind, this is a long-running thing. We're looking at 15 years now that we've had subsidies propping up the solar industry. And keep in mind, I would love it. Nothing would make me happier than for solar to say, screw you, we don't need the subsidies anymore. We are, you know, for every dollar you spend on a solar panel, you get $2 worth of energy out of it. That's where we want to be. We all agree on that. But it's difficult, and it's very easy to come up with excuses with why solar isn't here. And the real reason is because it's hard. It's hard to come up with something that's energy efficient, that's clean to create for the environment, that people can buy affordably. And if we could, somebody would just make it overnight and then we would all buy it. And of course, there's a messy process as we get here. And when I read a story like this that says, how come Europe can have magic solar panels that make everything rainbows and we can't? It's very easy to say, you know, because big oil and something about Dick Cheney. I hate that argument. It's a false dichotomy, but idiotic.
Okay, Brian. Wait a second. Did anyone say because big oil and Dick Cheney? I think the story is just, hey, there are solar panels at IKEA. That's kind of cool.
No, that's just it, Patrick. If that was the story, then I would be thrilled. But you'll notice the headline reads, there's solar panels at IKEA in Europe. What's stopping them from coming to America? It's like, dude, I hate that stuff.
Because we already have a lot of options. Because we can buy them at Costco for less money.
Okay, wait, hold on. let me be in the voice of neutrality here. And not Patrick. I'm going to ask you this question. And that is, it's clear to me that, so Patrick wants to save the planet and Brian wants to destroy the planet. Where do you fall in between that?
I'm married to a Swedish Finn. So I think I'm contractually obliged to side with whatever IKEA is doing. So,
was that part of the vows?
I think so.
as we recited them, I think it was somewhere in there, you know.
I vowed to obey, Swedish, to love, and to buy solar.
Yeah.
Or solar.
You know, the Nokia thing was already hitting us pretty hard in my couple. So I really think I shouldn't say anything bad about IKEA. So yeah.
Save a marriage, change the subject.
I mean, honestly, I think IKEA, what the fact that it's arriving at IKEA, it's obviously a test. You know, I don't think it has anything to do with big oil or you know, with Dick Cheney's evil plans to ruin the planet. It's just that they're testing it in that market first, as many companies often do. And if it's super successful, I'm fairly sure they're going to, you know, bring it over to other places. You know why? Because they like money. And if they sell, they're going to sell it to other people. So it's, I don't think there's anything nefarious there. And I didn't read the article, but if they're saying there's something nefarious, they're probably misguided. And I don't think either that these panels are, you know, magically becoming better because they're at IKEA. It's just that they're a little bit more readily accessible, and that's probably a good thing for those who want to use them.
I was going to say, I like one of the comments in the chat room. There are rice soda pops in Chinese McDonald's. U.S. must wait. I mean, you know, Schwinn got totally scammed on a title. You got sucked in on a title because it's like the second paragraph of this article is so benign, but it might be a while longer before their American counterparts will be able to do the same.
Conspiracy.
I think the L.A. Times trolled Brian. I think that's what happened.
It's not hard at all, Brian. All you got to do is imply that someone thinks they're better than someone else. Like, what?
You know, I'd like to say, as before we move on, that you three being married with kids and me being celibate, I'm more carbon neutral than any of you.
Know that. We're all married to each other.
I could drive a Suburban around the city throwing coal out the window, and I'd still be more carbon neutral
than
all of
you. But if you just burn the coal, that would pretty much fix it.
Now, right after the break, we are going to come back, and I'm going to wind up Brian once more because I have one more story that I'm sure is going to just do just like that. Just like that. Brian, could you – what's that?
It's like I didn't even know what you're up to, but you know how to get my goat, and I'm going to go to the bathroom. Screw this.
Okay. While Brian is taking care of his solar problem, I want to take some time to talk about GoToMeeting because they are a supporter of This Week in Tech. Now, if you've watched any of my shows, you know that I love GoToMeeting because we all understand that we need to meet. We need to talk to our colleagues, to our coworkers, to our customers. We need to have that face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact in order to get things done. But when you work in different offices, in different cities, in different countries, sometimes it's just difficult to get that face-to-face time, which is why we love GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It's the incredibly easy way to meet online and see each other in HD. Now, you see, with GoToMeeting, you can share screens. It makes it easier for your team to be on the same page. And if you turn on your webcam, it makes it that simple for your meeting to become an HD video conference. Imagine the kind of data that you get when you can actually see the person that you're talking to. It's not just a voice coming over a speaker. It's not a disembodied stream of words coming at you. You can see that small frown or that raised eyebrow or that slightly quizzical look on someone's face that tells them, you don't understand or I don't understand you, and therefore you need to continue. That's what you get with GoToMeeting. You get that extra dimension of communication. One of the things I love about GoToMeeting is that it works from anywhere. I've used it on my laptop. I've used it on my desktop. I've used it on my phone. They make it easy for me to meet and share from anywhere, even from my iPad. You can present from your iPad. How much coolness is that, to be that mobile and that connected at the same time? I love GoToMeeting, and you know I mean it because I'm not just an endorser of the product. I use it on a daily basis. I use this product to talk with the dozens of people that I need to talk to in my real job around the country, around the world. I use GoToMeeting, and I love it, and I know that you will too. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting. I want to see if you're going to find it to be as valuable as I do. So to try GoToMeeting free for 30 days, visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code TWIT. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing, and we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Tech. Guys, I want to bring it home with one more story here.
Brace yourselves.
And
I know.
And Brian's totally going to love this. I mean, I know he's right on board with the fact that the FAA panel has suggested that they sort of relax the standards on turning off devices on airplanes. Because you know, I know Brian was a big proponent of having those devices off in the first place because he believes it's the government's place to make sure that we're all safe. So that cell phone, which could potentially down your 747 on its approach, well, it was right that it was off. Brian, I mean, you're lamenting this decision, right? I mean, you're just...
I just want to cry. This is the best news I've heard in my life. Hey, well, when did this happen? They say you can keep your devices on during takeoff and landing.
No.
Not quite.
The FAA received the report and recommendations today on the expanded use of personal electronic devices. FAA spokesman Les Dorr told Mashable in a mail on Monday. The administrator will review the report and determine next steps.
Right. So essentially they've said, you know what, maybe we were a bit too strict. We should look at the policies again. So there's no right. Recommendation saying, hey, you know what, if they want to start up a fax machine in the middle of takeoff, go ahead. But at least this is a step in the right direction. Yes.
Padre SJ, let this be the day that goes down in history as the only day that a priest gave me false hope.
Well...
Only day?
The hope is there.
Wow.
The hope is there.
It's pretty good average. Here's the thing, though.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, the report does not recommend changing rules restricting activities that require a network connection, such as voice calls or data transfer. Those will likely remain off limits as rules for cell phone use on planes have been governed by the FCC since 1991. The advisory committee did suggest the FAA should work with the FCC to reassess those restrictions as well, the Wall Street Journal reported.
Yeah. I like to read this story in concert with, I believe it was 3 or 4 months ago, there was a researcher who showed that he could overpower the navigation computer inside of a computer, if inside of a plane, if he had a transmitter in first class that was aimed towards that computer with enough power, he could actually send it false signals and take the plane off course. Now, I think we would all notice if someone had a big old satellite dish looking thing pointed towards the cockpit. But you know what the FAA is essentially saying is, look, unless you're that guy, yeah, the device you bring on the plane, it's got no ability to cause any sort of crash or incident or accident.
Well, yes and no. They're saying it should remain in airplane mode. You're not supposed to be using, you know, your network data transmitting parts of your device.
But how many of us have accidentally left the phone on while taking off? It's up in the overhead bin. And,
okay.
No, that's a good point.
Can I say that this story and this continuing story over the past, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, now I'm going to be the European guy.
Oh.
I mean, this is a very, I'm not going to say American, this is a very American-centric thing. I understand this is an important topic and it needs to be discussed. And yes, I want to be using my iPad for the 10 minutes and takeoff and landing that I can't use it. But I mean, come on, the proportion of coverage that this issue, using air quotes, has been getting on tech shows is ridiculous. Yes, mention it here and there, but is it that big an issue in your lives that we need to discuss it every... I mean, come on.
How often do you fly?
Patrick, Patrick, that the only reason I still subscribe to Wired Magazine is because it's the only magazine that I can read during that 10 minutes of takeoff and landing. And let me tell you, for the record, I do not approve of people leaving their iPads on inside their backpacks underneath the seat in front of them on 3G networks. I do not approve of people who leave their iPhones on in their pockets and then only put on one earbud as they pretend to be asleep so they can continue listening to their audiobook during takeoff and landing. That's not okay because it's against the law, and we should no longer have to stand for that illegal behavior.
So decriminalize Schwood.
Maybe.
This just confirms what I always knew about you, Brian. You are a big proponent of the nanny state.
Oh, I like chicks who dress up as nannies. That's kind of hot.
That's really an overshare, Brian. Is an overshare.
Let me find another story really quickly. Awkward. All right. Here's one story. It's actually semi-serious. Let's take it back. Take it down a notch. Okay, we've had our fun with exploding cars and death rays on planes. You know, Twitter's going IPO, right? And so, as Twitter goes IPO, there are some obvious comparisons between it and Facebook. One of the interesting things that just came out this last week is the CEO of Twitter saying, and I quote, we are the anti-Facebook. And he points out several reasons why Twitter's not going to be like the Facebook IPO. Because they're already focused on mobile. Because they have a strategy for making money. Because they're not going to do that weird thing that Facebook did with their PR agency. You know, they have a clear idea of where they want the company to be with this IPO money versus what they say was Facebook's problem of just feeling that they needed to go IPO without actually knowing what they were going to do with that cash. I bring this up at the end of the show because, you know, I don't like all the speculation. We know we know that Twitter is going to go IPO. We know that they're going to make a ton of cash. I just want to open up to the panel and say, if they open at their target price, which I actually can't call up right now. Let's call it $20. They open at $20. Is this a stock that you would actually invest your hard-earned cash in? Do you see enough of a business model there? Regardless of how important you think Twitter is, do you see it making money enough to justify an investment?
I don't buy tech. I don't buy tech stocks.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm hypothetically, so if we were, if we weren't in the tech industry and we couldn't get sued by the SEC for hyping up stocks that we were going to buy, would you buy?
Isn't that answering that question? Isn't that the reason why we could, you know, get in trouble? I mean, I'm not a journalist, so I could answer it, but I don't know. I mean, look at the lower thirds on this show. We have the website name for most of us, right? We have the website name and the Twitter handle. And that's something that ultimately everyone keeps coming back to Twitter all the time. Mm-hmm. I say everyone, the people who are interested in these sorts of things. And Twitter has, what is it, 200, 250 million users. A chunk of those might be fake users. That's, you know, to be expected. Right. But I have a hard time imagining that a mode of communication that has that many users, that is so ubiquitous now in every aspect of the media, on TV, and, you know, everywhere you see hashtags, I have a hard time thinking that this thing is not going to end up making money at some point. It's already making money, but it's not going to end up going up. And it is already seeing nice trends in every metric. It's not Facebook, and some people are failing it, you know, are saying that this is a bad thing because it doesn't have the Facebook numbers. Facebook numbers are unbelievable. You know, 1.26 million users. That is not something that you compare your service to, because it's unreal. But 250 million users is not something to scoff at. So,
but you can compare the fact that when Twitter had its IPO, it was profitable. And more importantly, it had figured out how to crack, how to sell to its audience. Facebook has figured out how to sell and make money. Twitter has never done that. Twitter has, and it has a big problem. For example, that article that you put it in the doc, Padre, but the Twitter's fire hose problem, the fact that the more people join Twitter and the more people you follow, the less valuable Twitter becomes and the harder it is to sell targeted ads, it is a real problem. And the fact that last quarter they lost, what was it like? I forget what the number is, but they lost money. These are big problems going into an IPO.
Yeah, yeah. Last word on Twitter? No? Kind of done with it.
I don't know. I always thought the whole maybe I just haven't read the right article, but to me it seemed like the anti-Facebook was Twitter trying to say, you know, if you buy at 38, it's not going to drop 20% before rising 88% like 8 months later. It's
it's business speak.
It's Wall Street.
Yeah, it's Wall Street.
It's a rigged game, man.
But you know what's not Wall Street? Tom Merritt. With us, look at the week ahead.
Hey, thanks, Father Robert. Here's a look at some of the things we'll be keeping an eye on in the week ahead on Tech News Today. Monday, October 7th, MIPCOM kicks off. That's the conference where all the TV show and movie makers get together to try to sell their wares, and more web stuff and more web companies have been showing up at that. Wednesday, October 9th is MTech from MIT. That's an emerging technology conference. Thursday, October 10th, the Samsung Galaxy Note 10.1 tablet 2014 edition comes out in the United States. And Saturday, October 12th, Hack 5 releases the next version of its Wi-Fi pineapple in Richmond, California, or live on YouTube. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Father Robert.
Thanks, Tom. You know, I want to thank all of our panelists. My gosh, this has been a really fast 2 hours. I just realized we hit 2 hours. I want to thank all of you for giving up a Sunday to just reminisce with me about the tech of the week. Yeah, Patrick, I love whenever you're on the Twit TV network. Tell us, where can they find your work and what are you doing? I'm sorry, not Patrick.
I was confused. I was like, he's looking at the screen, but Patrick is right next to him. What's happening?
It's complicated, man.
Well, thank you very much for having me, first of all. It was a blast. I do a bunch of podcasts in French. The latest of one is called Positron. You don't say it like this, but it's Positron in French. And we just recommend some cool stuff like movies, TV shows, comic books, books, albums, music, stuff like that. And it's just a fun 20 minutes with two friends. And it's really a joyful show. So I encourage, if you've been depressed by This Week in Tech and you speak French, then go ahead and find it on frenchspin.com. And if you want to find more of me, you will be going to Twitter. My handle is, as you might have guessed, not Patrick. Thank you, Chad, for the coordinated screen grabs.
That's that. We love Chad. He's awesome like that. Of course, you could always find him at patrickbeja.com.
Now, as well,
the not Patrick, does that? Yeah, that's right. Is sitting right next to me, Patrick Norton. I mean, what don't you do? You do This Week in Computer Hardware on the Twit TV network. You do Techzilla. Tell us what's coming up. What are you going to be able to dazzle our viewers with?
I'm going to dazzle you with actually a discussion of FreeNAS coming up next week on Techzilla. We have something coming up on HD Nation. Oh, we've got the Sonos soundbar we're talking about on HD Nation, which is a show I do with Robert Herron.
That was an awful lot of...
There's a little autoplay on that website. Sorry about that. And we just... you know, I just did something, and I can't remember what it is, but techzilla.com, T-E-K-Z-I-L-L-A. And look, you can see the little Discovery Digital Network underneath Revision 3 now.
Yay.
It's and Veronica Belmont looking sassy with the two old guys.
Oh, we got snubs. We have our sass quotient. Speaking of our sass quotient, Big part of that is Mr. Brian Brushwood. Yeah, we'll just roll with it. Well, Brian Brushwood, who is our, he's our resident scam school. Did you call yourself a jackass once? I can't remember.
It may be in my profile on Twitter, but you'll never find out what my Twitter handle is. In fact, I dare you to find me. I'll bet you can't ever find my Facebook, my Instagram, my Google+, or my Twitter.
Oh!
Curse yous! Fine! I'm live, and you can find me online, but I'm not going to say how. Audio listeners, you'll have to find it. Boo! I'm ashamed of being me.
And cut.
Worst lie you've ever told me.
Now, I want to close out the show, but first, Chad's got to push this button that's going to show you what you missed if you haven't been watching Twit all this week.
Previously on Twit... Gizwiz.
This is called the Squatty Potty. How's it going back there?
Not so good.
I'd just like you to test this out here. How's it going for you in there now?
OMG Craft.
Icicle. Bye, bicycle. Test. Testing 1, 2, 3.
This week in YouTube.
Oh, wait, what?
Day you buy.
Camera.
Sorry.
Are you taking my face?
It has a screen on the back that doesn't allow you to see what's on your own thing.
What?
Like,
Wait a minute.
Taking a selfie.
You're such a ham.
All about Android.
Chad, what's up?
Hey, nothing.
iPad today.
And ways to grow. Reading Rainbow.
OMG Twit. You heard me.
Rainbow. A pretty rainbow.
I had no idea that was a parody to play.
We've just been chat rolled.
That big thanks to Anthony, who edited that, and then I didn't watch it before the show.
That was brilliant. That was brilliant.
Fantastic.
OMG Twit. Chad, but before we let you go, we can find you on the Twit TV network. What are you?
I guess I board off All About Android. I host This Week in YouTube. I also host OMG Craft. And then I do the video switching for Twit, Twig, Mac Break Weekly. So that's why I was on all that
You're
stuff.
You're on everything.
The only thing that bummed me out was that test 1, 2, 3 bit. Like, do you remember what college we picked that up like? Because you and I were both there at that college when we were touring together, and somebody did it live, and it blew us away. We loved it.
I remember. So, yeah, I completely forget which college we were, but they were testing the mics, and they did that test, and it is – I have stolen it outright, like, and I will tell everyone it's plagiarized, but I do that every single time that I can.
It's brilliant.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
It's great.
Funny.
And on that note, I think we have to close out. I'm actually Father Robert. You can find me Mondays here on Twit on Mondays at noon. And Know How at 3 o'clock on Thursdays. But you know what? just don't do that. Just go to Twitter and find me, PadreSJ. Follow me and you'll find all the different places that I pop up on the Twit TV network. Thanks to everyone, especially to Chad, to Anthony, to Patrick, to Jammer B, to Burke, to our panelists, to Patrick, not Patrick, and some other guy also not named Patrick. And to the thousands of people currently in our studio audience, which is fantastic. I mean, I haven't seen a turnout like this. In fact, here, let yourself be heard.
You know, they're so coordinated, they speak as if one voice, as Padre.
As if one, or maybe two. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, and another twit
this is
in the can.